This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
Soccer fails to score. Alicia, basketball comes up short. But the Dolphins, at least, are close to a goal line. We start this week on the field with the field of incentives for the Dolphins, the court of disappointment for the Heat, and the imperfect pitch of Major League Soccer.
David Beckham is a global soccer star still in search of a home in Miami. This week, the city of Miami rejected the idea of filling in a boat slip on the bayfront in downtown Miami and building a soccer stadium there. This was the second proposed location to fail to get government support. The first idea was building a stadium at Port Miami, and that was rejected by county commissioners.
That would be nil two now for the Beckham group here in Miami. So where now for Major League Soccer? The old Orange Bowl site near Marlins Park, Watson Island. How about Marine Stadium on Virginia Key? Let us know your thoughts at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Email us at thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org. thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org or on Twitter at WLRN is the call sign. Steve Rothaus from the Miami Herald is with us in studio all hour long. Steve, it's always great to have you along. And Patty Mazzei from the Miami Herald is joining us via Skype. Patty, let's begin with you. The Miami City Mayor was at the initial meeting to announce the boat slip, and the boat slip option slipped away entirely this week. What happened?
Well, to clarify, the mayor never made a public announcement in terms of going to a press conference with the Beckham people. He said when County Mayor Carlos Jimenez proposed the slip, City Mayor Tomas Regalado said, yes, this sounds great. Let's talk about it. But he very quickly seems to have changed his mind in light of some opposition from neighbors who wanted the park to remain green space and not to have a stadium there. Also, some hesitation from city commissioners, although the city commissioners later said he shouldn't have assumed that we were going to vote against it just because we were questioning it, and also because the talks with the University of Miami over having a joint stadium at the site broke down when Beckham's folks seemed to realize that a large 40,000-seat stadium that would also seat college football would probably not fit there.
Yeah, two purposes for one stadium. Major League Soccer has made it known it'd like about 22 to 25,000 seat stadium. University of Miami would like, obviously, a larger stadium to fit its football fans in the fall. The Beckham group, though, Patty, has acknowledged, obviously, the boat slip is no longer an option. Port Miami is no longer an option. They previously have called the old Orange Bowl site tainted. So what's left?
I'm not sure. They said they have to regroup and consider their options. There is a push from some elected officials in the city and county to get them to seriously look at the site next to Marlins Park, despite that comment from Beckham's business partner, Simon Fuller, who said, you know, that the Marlins deal was just too unpopular to put a stadium next door that would be smaller and, you know, eclipsed by the roof of Marlins Park. There's some city and county officials who say, you know, forget about that. Just really take a close, hard look. And they think UM would be amenable to that, even though the site, at least the way it is right now, it's my understanding that it's also a pretty tight squeeze.
Where would it be? Orient us to where this potential soccer stadium could go next to Marlins Park. If you're at home plate, for instance, at Marlins Park, where would this proposed soccer stadium possibly go?
Behind you. I mean, it would go
to the west. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
To the west of Marlins Park, along 17th Avenue, there are some city-owned parcels that are now used for surface parking for the baseball stadium. And there are some privately owned homes there, small apartments and duplexes, that would have to be bought out, presumably, because the city parcels are separated by this private home. So it wouldn't fit without taking those homes in some way.
Patty Mazzei with the Miami Herald. I'm Tom Hudson. Alicia Zuckerman along with me. Steve Rothaus also from the Herald. Steve, do you think the charm offensive has failed for David Beckham in South Florida? It's a nil two looking for a soccer site.
Well, I think that in this case, it probably has failed, or at least is failing. I think that people were more interested in preserving the site than they were charmed by David Beckham.
Let's go to the calls here. Omar is joining us from Miami here on the Florida Roundup. Omar, go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. My question is, I'm in my mid-20s. I'm on the outside looking in. I'm not into sports. I don't watch football, basketball, soccer, nothing. But my age group in my 20s, my friends, they're always talking about the Miami Heat, basketball. And does South Florida really provide a strong base for a soccer team or a stadium?
Yeah, this
because
is the
age. We already spend so much money on a baseball stadium, and a lot of people don't go to it.
Yep. Omar from Miami, and I'll put the question to you, Patty. This is an age-old question when it comes to professional soccer. Certainly here in South Florida, it has failed in the past to gain a sustainable audience. There's lots of folks that play, but turning those players into ticket holders is something altogether different.
Yeah, the pitch that Beckham's group wants to make is that this could be everyone's second team. If you're a soccer fan and you root for Real Madrid or something like that, then this could be your second team locally. You could still be a fan of European soccer or Latin American soccer, but come here and see these games live. And yeah, they have said that they want some downtown location because they want to attract the bodies, and they fear that if they're further out west, that's just not going to happen. And Major League Soccer doesn't sound too interested in risking failure again in Miami if they're in a site that they're less than comfortable with.
Greg Cody with the Miami Herald is joining us on the phone. Greg, we're seeing David Beckham on the sidelines of the Heat playoff series. Is this presumably paying forward if he's successful in getting soccer in Miami, that those Heat players would wind up on the sidelines of a professional soccer match in Florida?
You never know. There may be some reciprocity there. I know LeBron James has a piece of some European soccer interests, so he's heavily into it. I think he would be involved in some small way, maybe as a figurehead of sorts. But Beckham's got to get it done first, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, speaking of having to get it done, the Heat have to get it done, certainly in the days ahead. History is not on the side of the Heat. No team, Alicia, has come back from a two-game deficit in the NBA Finals. No team in the history of the Finals has it happened from this deep of a hole, but this is where the Heat find themselves now, down 3-1 against the Spurs in the best-of-seven series.
San Antonio might just be better. I mean, it might be time to just sort of say that and own it, as Eric Spoelstra likes to say.
That sounds awfully familiar, Greg Cody, to you. You said it last night on your wrap-up for the MiamiHerald.com. Do you still stand behind that? Do we have to own up to it? Is it time for some community intervention and acknowledge that perhaps the Heat is not the best team in the NBA this season?
Yeah, based on the last two games, I would say that's the case. In a situation like this, there's a tendency to blame the Heat and to say what's wrong with Miami and calamity and distress and all of that stuff. But at some point you just have to look at the beautiful basketball San Antonio is playing and say that they're the better team, and there's no great shame in that. This is Miami's fourth finals in a row, and they've won twice, and it's been a great run, but right now they are facing a better team in the Spurs.
Yeah, Greg, not only are they a better team so far in this series, but they're hungry. There's no question about it. I get the sense that they're still mad from last year. One of the commentators on ABC last night said of the Spurs, the defense has been suffocating, the offense sublime. And about halfway through the third quarter, he called the Spurs lead on Miami's home court shocking. What have you seen? Why is it that the Heat have not been able to kind of step up and do what they do and do what we're so used to seeing them do?
Well, San Antonio is the best team in the league by a lot, and I think that's showing in this series. LeBron isn't getting much help. Last night he scored 28 points, and the other four starters combined scored 28 points. Dwayne Wade had an awful game. It's weird. LeBron came here from Cleveland to get away from the idea that he was a superstar alone with no help, but that's what he looked like last night. And so, even if a miracle happens, even if Miami were to win three games and another championship, this is still a Heat team that is old and has deficiencies and needs some retooling after the season.
So do you think we're going to see some trades? I mean, these three have been playing together. They came together to do this. They took pay cuts, and it certainly paid off over the last several seasons. But what does this performance mean for, say, next season?
I think that I think there's a good chance you'll see the big three, James, Wade, and Bosch, back. There's a lot of speculation now that the Heat are discussing internally the idea of going after potential free agent Carmelo Anthony of the Knicks, who could be added to create what amounts to a big four. That would take some real financial finagling to make that work, but reportedly the Heat want to make it work, so that's pretty exciting if you're a Heat fan. But Miami needs to do something in the offseason to get better.
Well, I was going to ask if the fans are sort of fair-weather fans, as Heat fans have so often been accused of. We haven't known that over the last several years, but I think if we see Carmelo Anthony in the mix, the fair-weather thing goes out the window. Everybody's going to show up to see those four play together.
Yeah, I mean, he would be an exciting signing for sure. He and LeBron are close friends. I mean, there are a lot of reasons to think it could happen. Certainly, Carmelo would be very interested in coming here and playing for a championship. So if they get Carmelo, then the run of excellence continues. But they need to make changes. This they dominated a weak Eastern Conference, but they're running into the best of the West right now and getting handled.
Greg Cody covering the Heat for the Miami Herald with us here on the Florida Roundup. Patty Mazze covers Miami-Dade County politics. And Patty, let me ask you, how perfect was the timing on the Heat lease deal here that had happened before this Spurs series to get it done? Because maybe the terms would be slightly different if the Heat went into the negotiations with the county regarding the AAA lease down two games in the championship series.
Yeah, pretty perfect. The Heat said that they last year when they started to wanted to reopen these negotiations, that it had nothing to do with their run right now, that it was mostly because they're trying to do financial planning. But I think it's hard to say that, you know, they know politically that they have goodwill and that they did. And I'm not sure that they would lose that if they lose this series necessarily. But certainly they wanted to kind of capitalize on the good name that they've built for themselves in recent years.
And we're seeing some negotiations happen up north a little bit. Steve Rothaus from the Miami Herald. We've got the Dolphins and Stephen Ross in negotiations. Look like next week, Patty, that the county commissioners may vote on this deal. That would essentially open the way for Ross to go forward with $350 million in renovations to Sun Life and then provide hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in incentives if he and the Dolphins are successful in attracting some big events to Sun Life. What's the likelihood that this gets through the commission?
Well, the county commission, hasn't really been as vociferous on this deal as it has on the negotiations with the Heat or with Beckham. Because of that, I think it would be unlikely that it doesn't go through unless we kind of see a revolt on the dais, which is possible. They haven't, this didn't go through a committee, and that's something that upsets commissioners sometimes, that they go straight for a vote on a full commission and doesn't go through the usual process of, let's take this to a smaller committee and iron it out and then bring it back for a final vote.
Let me ask kind of everybody to pipe in here. Anecdotally, the return on investment, public or otherwise, both the attention, the time, and the financial details on these kinds of investments. And Greg Cody, I'll begin with you. You cover these teams very closely. You understand the fan base for the Dolphins, the fan base for the Heat, the potential fan base for Major League Soccer, the return on investment for the community. Which ones do you think is a better investment? The Heat deal at the AAA? The Dolphins investment for incentives to pay for big events should they come to Sun Life, a renovated Sun Life, or the potential of a privately funded Major League Soccer stadium in Miami-Dade County?
Yeah, I'd probably put soccer third on that list, not because it's a particularly weak option, but simply because it's not a proven entity. The Heat have proven that when they're successful, the fans are going to turn out, and they're going to be a moneymaker. You know, the Dolphins are sort of a latent flagship right now. Keep in mind, this was a football town for 40 years, and it only hasn't been since the Heat signed LeBron James. So, Dolphin fans will return in force when the team produces a winning team. But it's not, for me, it's not about stadium improvements. Dolphins fans think that the stadium is fine and don't particularly care about getting a Super Bowl here unless the Dolphins are playing in it. So I think that's sort of a disconnect in all of this, is that Stephen Ross may want stadium improvements. Dolphin fans just want a winning team.
They want team improvements. Steve Rothaus, what do you think? A better investment for the community?
Well, I was just curious. Several years ago, Stephen Ross had talked about putting a theme park next to the stadium, and would this be the property that they would be considering for the soccer stadium?
Patty Mazze, any ideas on that?
No, No, there haven't been any talks about putting soccer next to the Dolphins Stadium. They just don't see that as an attractive site. They think that the soccer fans are younger urban people who are just more likely to be in downtown or the beach.
Sun Life will remain a different kind of football than football, I suppose, at this point.
Yes, it looks like it.
Patty, this is Steve. I was just curious whether you've been hearing any more rumbling from the soccer people as to, you know, basically saying, you know, we could go elsewhere. We could just simply leave the community.
There's a report in Yahoo Sports late last night that suggested that Beckham could be courted by MLS to take over Chivas USA, which is a troubled MLS franchise in LA. Mm-hmm. And the Beckham group has kind of declined to confirm or deny that report, saying, you know, they don't discuss specifics and that Miami remains their preferred choice. But, you know, they have always said that there are other cities that would welcome Beckham as an MLS team owner. So they're not really saying one way or the other.
Patty Mazzei covering Miami-Dade politics for us for the Miami Herald. Steve Rothaus also along with us for the full hour here on the Florida Roundup. And Greg Cody covering the Miami Heat for the Miami Herald and here at WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson along with Alicia Zuckerman. Stay close. Still to come, Ready or Not, the World Cup kicks off in Brazil. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening.
And I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
Well, pretty much I told my boss to not count with me on the days of the Brazilian games. And I have all blocked off on my calendar.
Oh, I die for soccer. Because I grow up with soccer, I will die with soccer. Because Brazil is the best.
The sounds of the World Cup as it kicks off in Brazil, the sounds of enjoying it, hopefully mostly enjoying it for Brazilian fans in South Florida. The host team won that first match yesterday, 3-1 against Croatia. Not without controversy, though. A questionable penalty call and Brazil scoring the first goal of the cup, although it was an own goal, Alicia, so not necessarily something to celebrate in those opening moments of the match.
And there were clashes between police and protesters outside the match in Sao Paulo, and demonstrators in Rio burned Brazilian flags chanting FIFA go home. FIFA is the governing global body of international soccer. So how do complaints about the billions of dollars spent on the preparations threaten the games? Are you taking off work in the weeks ahead to watch the matches? And what are the politics of football with a presidential election looming in Brazil? Call us at 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. And we have our live blog where you can join the conversation there at WLRN.org.
Steve Rothaus from the Miami Herald is with us all hour. Tim Padgett, our America's editor here at WLRN Miami Herald News, also along with us. Tim, this first match yesterday between Brazil and Croatia went off without any obvious operational trouble, at least inside the stadium that was on display in front of the globe's TV lenses. Is Brazil ready?
That has yet to be determined because just, you know, one game, you know, going off without a hitch. We've still got 11 other stadiums that we have to see if, you know, if they're ready. We've also got airports, metro lines, etc., about which there are big questions of readiness. So, you know, it's going to take a week or so to see if Brazil has really gotten all of these preparation problems ironed out and things can go smoothly for both players and fans.
Steve Rothaus, the game in the first 12 minutes, the talk was, of course, the own goal of Brazil, but there was a lot going on even prior to that. The pomp and circumstance of World Cup was on full display as Brazil really took the world's attention.
Well, absolutely. And at first, Jennifer Lopez, who was scheduled to be in the opening show, she somehow declined and then changed her mind and was back wearing a sparkly leotard outfit. But Pitbull, Pitbull is the person who attracted the most attention online, you know, after this performance because of his white capri pants.
Very Miami. If
you haven't seen them, you need to go online. You need to look at the photos. They're everywhere. And, you know, whether you like them or not, if you go to MiamiHerald.com to the homepage, there's a link where you could see the picture. And they're actually doing a poll whether or not you like these pants.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, there was questionable calls during the match itself in the 90 minutes. Was that a questionable call before the opening kickoff, Rothaus, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, some of the tweets that have gone out, one person said, seriously considering Pitbull as my Halloween getup this year. I mean, just really funny. And somebody else questioning whether that they didn't have a sparkly leotard in Pitbull's size, and was that why he was wearing the white capri pants? But, I mean, lots of talk.
The controversy wasn't just sartorial either. I mean, it was linguistic. Here we go. J-Lo and Pitbull. I think FIFA forgot that in Brazil, they speak Portuguese.
Yeah. And is that part and parcel of FIFA's egotism, as it is, as an organization coming in and kind of, you know, questions moving into this cup about its own governance problems, problems with referees taking buy-offs in qualifying matches, and real questions about FIFA's ability to operate as a developed world body ought to operate.
No, it's hard to tell right now in Brazil what is the most hated institution at this moment, whether it's FIFA or the Brazilian government for sort of pandering to FIFA's very unreasonable requirements in many cases for, you know, the requirements for stadium renovations and things like that, that really helped lead to the billion-dollar cost overruns are such a source of anger right now.
$500 million was one of the original estimates that we heard when the World Cup was awarded to Brazil back in 2007.
Brazilian officials said that they could renovate all the stadiums for less than $1 billion, the actual price tag, almost $4 billion.
And we know inflation is running rampant in Brazil, but that's something that's altogether different.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So what about inside Brazil? I mean, you spoke with Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR's correspondent in São Paulo. You've spoken with other sources throughout the continent and the hemisphere. We did see, you know, a few thousand people demonstrated in Rio, a few hundred people demonstrated in São Paulo. Nothing like the demonstrations and the transit strikes that we saw a year ago.
No, really, you're going to see in the next 4 weeks that the zeal in Brazil for futebol is going to begin to overshadow a lot of the melees and the anger on the part of Brazilians. They, for all of their anger, they do want to see the Brazilian team win this thing. The one dilemma, as one described it to me, is that, you know, if they do win the thing, that actually helps the government, and a lot of Brazilians don't want to help the government. So, you know, I mean, Dilma Rousseff, the president, could see her job saved if Brazil wins the cup.
Alicia, we asked our Public Insight Network for thoughts on Brazil and whether or not Brazilians have lost enthusiasm as the cup has approached here. Edward from Palmetto Bay wrote us, quote, "The locals may not appreciate the event as much now, but if Brazil wins their sixth World Cup, everything will be forgiven. As for soccer fans, we want to see great games, and the fact that stadiums haven't been finished is more of a running joke than a real concern."
Right, and Roland from Miami said, "Football is still God. However, the message that they are giving to the world is that football is only a sport that should not be put ahead of education, healthcare, and human development. The people that are protesting are not against football, but the cost of the games and the shady business side."
And that's what you're seeing reflected, Tim, on the streets, I think, in some of these major cities. And will it continue with the 11 or the 9 other cities that may not be right on the tips of the tongues of Americans when they think of Brazil?
Well, a lot of people are saying that's one of the silver linings of this whole World Cup mess in Brazil. The Atlantic Council this past week put out a very interesting report saying that one of the benefits of all this controversy is that Brazil is sort of growing now beyond that obsession with soccer, and they're beginning to realize that there are a lot more things that are more important, such as the services that Alicia, you know, just mentioned, and that's going to really help Brazil's democracy and therefore its genuine development.
Dilma Rousseff gained in the polls when she canceled her state dinner with President Obama here in the United States over the acknowledgement of the National Security Administration tapping into phone calls that she was making, tapping into emails and communications that Petrobrasil was making, the energy company. But she seems to have lost a lot of that goodwill that she had just, you know, 6-9 months or so ago. How much of her political fate in October in the presidential election truly is tied to the pitch of the 11 gentlemen playing football?
Well, all you have to consider is that a new poll out in Brazil shows that almost 3/4 of voters in the population of Brazil think the country is headed in the wrong direction. That is not what an incumbent president wants to see in just a matter of months before her reelection bid, which is all the more important why not just that Brazil wins, but that somehow the Brazilian government shows that, yes, in the end, this was a benefit for the country. But I spoke to a Brazilian woman from Sao Paulo yesterday outside a Brazilian restaurant who was going in to watch the game. And she said, look, even if we do win, this anger is not going to go away, and that Dilma could still be in trouble in October.
Is that a promise or a threat, do you think?
I think a threat, more than anything else. But it does show that, you know, again, as we were saying, that even if the Brazil team does win, if Dilma still is in trouble, I think that shows a real sea change in Brazil.
There's a different contest going on in South America this Sunday in Colombia. It's a runoff presidential election. President Juan Manuel Santos is working to defend his strategy of negotiating peace with the guerrilla group FARC. Tim Padgett with WLR and Miami Herald News still with us. Steve Rothhaus with the Miami Herald. I'm Tom Hudson, Alicia Zuckerman. And we say hello to Sibila Brodzinski, a freelancer who writes for The Economist and Guardian based in Bogota. Sibila, welcome to the Florida Roundup. What kind of uphill battle does President Santos face on Sunday with this runoff election?
Well, thank you for inviting me. Santos and the opposition candidate, Oscar Iván Zuluaga, in the latest polls are really neck and neck, and it's really at this point anybody's call who's going to win on Sunday. For Santos, it's been a bizarre campaign, because just 3 or 4 months ago, it looked like he was sort of a shoo-in, and Zuluaga started rising in the polls and became a threat to Santos's re-election bid.
Sibila, I'm going to ask you, Sibila, we're going to switch over to the telephone. The Skype connection is a little bit iffy. And while we do that, Tim, I want you to discuss a little bit about really how much of this Colombian presidential election is a referendum on the peace negotiations that President Santos has undertaken with the guerrilla group FARC.
Well, it's very much a referendum on that issue. And what's surprising is that so many Colombians seem to be more and more ambivalent about the peace process, given the fact that Santos, it seemed at the beginning, had made a very good case to them that Colombia really can't move forward unless it does have, you know, if this war with the Marxist guerrillas known as the FARC, continues, then I think Santos has made the point that it takes away about a percentage point of GDP growth, for example, for Colombia each year. So he had made the point that, or the argument that the peace process was necessary for Colombia's movement forward, but Colombian voters don't seem so sure anymore.
Sibila Brzezinski with The Economist and The Guardian in Bogota, if it is a referendum on negotiating with the Marxist guerrilla group, the FARC, in terms of this Colombian presidential election, could it be argued at all there's a portion of the Colombian electorate that would like the negotiations to move farther, move faster, as opposed to cease them altogether?
Well, I think that's right. There's there are two things. There's a portion of the population that doesn't look kindly on negotiating with a group that has been labeled terrorist by the United States and the European Union, and feel that that the military advances made under former President Uribe could continue until the FARC were defeated militarily. The another part of the population fears actually that if the negotiations with the FARC are successful, just how many concessions the government is going to give into them in terms of justice and in terms of truth. And so there's that concern, about what will come once a deal is made, whether the FARC will be made to serve jail time, or what sort of reckoning they will have after 50 years of fighting the Colombian state.
So, Sibila or Tim, whichever one of you wants to take this question, if Zuluaga's wants to stop negotiations with the Santos opponent, if he wants to stop negotiations with the FARC, which has been basically wreaking havoc in Colombia for 50 years, what is his strategy exactly, and how realistic is that strategy?
I would defer to Sibila on that right now.
Okay. Well, he initially said that he would immediately suspend the negotiations. He then backtracked on that. I think bowing a little bit toward the conservative party, which is part of which is backing him, in that it wouldn't be an immediate suspension of the negotiations, but that he would look at what had been agreed to so far and give the FARC a month to end hostilities. And by
a
that,
month,
he's talking about recruiting
years.
Minors.
Yeah, and I think you also have to realize that what's driving a lot of Zuluaga's agenda is the fact that he is backed by former President Uribe, who is absolutely livid at the fact that Santos started negotiations with the FARC after Uribe spent a decade
right.
vanquishing them.
His engagement was more showing a show of force.
Right.
It was a show of force
and
Uribe, as opposed to appeasement.
And Uribe has a very personal stake against the FARC. Some of his relatives, had been killed in the conflict. So there's very much that factor at play here.
And a personal conflict with Santos as well.
Yeah, I mean, Santos...
Because he was his defense minister.
Santos was his defense minister during that campaign to defeat the FARC, and then suddenly Santos becomes president and begins to backtrack on a lot of what Uribe had done, and that has fueled Uribe's anger as well.
Sibila,
that's a good point.
Sibila Brzezinski, in Colombia, any expectations on turnout for the presidential runoff? And dare I ask it, do you anticipate a concession and an acknowledgement of a winner Sunday night or Monday?
Well, the abstention rate in the first round vote in May was extremely high. There's historically been about 50% abstention, and in May it was about 60%. I think the turnout on Sunday in part depends on Colombia-Greece match in the World Cup on Saturday.
All comes back to that, doesn't it?
All roads lead to the World Cup.
Yes, it does. I mean, a lot of observers are wondering whether, a Colombia win could help Santos, or, if a win will, have people hung over on Sunday and they don't want to go out to vote. but there has been a big push from both campaigns to get a lot of people who actually stayed home in May to take a stand in this election.
In the World Cup contest and politics in South America. Sibila, we've got to leave it there. Sibila Brzezinski, covering the Colombian presidential runoff for The Economist and The Guardian, with us in Bogota. Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here at WLRN. Steve Rothaus with Miami Herald. Alicia Zuckerman, and I'm Tom Hudson. Still to come on the Florida Roundup, the High Court in the Sunshine State gives the green light for some red light traffic ticket refunds.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
And I'm Tom Hudson.
And we're joined in the studio by David Ovalle from the Miami Herald, the Miami Herald's Steve Rothaus, and WLRN's Tim Padgett. Red light cameras are back in the news this week. These cameras have been controversial all over the country. And yesterday, the Florida Supreme Court, ruled that the city of Aventura and other cities in South Florida acted illegally when they implemented the red light camera system. Brett Luskin is the lawyer in Hallandale who filed the original lawsuit against the city of Aventura.
Everything they did was illegal, and essentially all of the money that they collected was illegal. All of that money is sort of ill-gotten gains.
So now, the state did regulate red light cameras in 2010. So, David, what was the basis of the lawsuit?
Well, back in back when in Aventura, when the program was first instituted in 2008, it was not a moving violation the way it is now. It was technically a code violation, which means if you wanted a contestant, you didn't go down to the courthouse like you would in a normal speeding ticket or something like that. You actually went down to City Hall, and they sort of had these sort of hearings that were basically created just for this purpose. And they would hire a hearing officers like a lawyer. And so the complaints were that it was basically a kangaroo court, that it was, you know, basically slanted and completely biased and tilted toward the city to collect money. So, and a lot of people didn't really understand the difference, and they just go, and then they'd pay the money. And so, you know, I'd been down there a couple of times, and I'd seen it, and it was a pretty bizarre sort of little setup they had going. And ultimately, the complaints were so much, and there were so many lawsuits filed over this issue, that the state stepped in and made it a uniform traffic citation, the same way it would be in, you know, for a speeding ticket or anything else you'd get on the roadway.
So Aventura created the first red light program in Miami-Dade back in 2008, but it wasn't the only one. What are some of the other Florida cities that followed suit before the 2010 legislation?
Oh, well, we have, Miami Gardens, we have Pembroke Pines, we have Florida City, we have Sweetwater. I mean, the list goes on and on. Most of those cities are still in litigation. Coral Gables, North Miami, all of these cities are still in litigation over this issue pre July 1st, 2010.
And what about these ill-gotten gains that the attorney Luskin talks about? How much money is going back to the people who were fined prior to, it's actually July 1st, 2010?
Well, that's sort of the question. I mean, the Supreme Court didn't really specify that refunds needed to be made, or how they would go about doing it. So it's going to really kind of play itself out in court. I noticed in Orlando, they're sort of disputing it and saying, well, if you didn't, the city attorney up there came out and said, well, if you didn't protest and you paid it right away, then you have no right to get your money back. And that's going to be a huge point of contention, because in essence, these courts, these sort of, you know, quote unquote hearings were illegal. So if you're someone that got one before 2010, you're going to think, hey, you know, even if you paid it, I want my money back. And so there's still going to be a big fight. I think the upper hand is now on the plaintiffs in a lot of these lawsuits that have been filed against these cities to get the full refund.
David, it's Tom. If it gets down to this, if you run a red light and nobody saw it, did you break a law? If you ran a red light before July 1st, 2010, and somebody saw it, the law may have been broken, but they didn't have a right to see it.
And if a tree fell in the forest,
right. Would somebody hear it? Right.
Right. Well, you know, the main complaint about these systems, and this persists even today, is that, you know, a lot of motorists say there's just sort of blatant cash grabs, you know, and they've tried to amend the procedures on these cases to really sort of streamline it and make it more equitable. You know, there was a lot of complaints, for example, if you stopped at a red light,
right.
and you didn't really stop enough,
right.
You know,
right.
And
right.
Kind of go, you know, so a lot of it was sort of, you know, subjective.
I got to tell you, Steve, I just in the last week or so paid a red light traffic violation that I had in Southern Dade County. I'm not too proud to admit to it, but I have to say, they had all the digital evidence there that I could review myself before deciding if I wanted to take my chances and make an argument in court or pay the lower fine and kind of have a much lower risk of just paying it and not having the points and not having and getting dinged on the insurance side of it. So the incentives are to pay it and move on.
Well, absolutely. I think that, you know, when you see it, when you go to the website and you see the video of you, you know, running the red light or making that illegal turn, I mean, it's not even that you can say to the cop, you know, didn't see it properly, that there was something that was not right, that the visibility, you see it. And the easiest thing to do is simply pay it. And of course, the question now is, if people simply opted to pay these fines pre-2010, so David, you're saying that they may not even be able to collect because they didn't go through this process.
Well, that's going to be the argument from some cities, I'm sure.
But the court has said those hearings,
right,
were illegal.
Right.
So
the
hearings themselves. So you can't acknowledge making an illegal moving violation if the hearing in which you rejected to have, had you had it, would have been illegal.
So the enforcement of the crime is illegal, basically.
Right. Right. Well, and it's not just that the courts, but just the whole program. They didn't have the authority to do it,
right.
Basically.
Right.
But they're not going to just carte blanche refund everyone who received a red light ticket.
Well, I imagine if some of these cities have decide that they are going to, you know, give back a lot of the money, then there's going to be sort of legal notices sent out. You'll see ads in papers, and they'll do their best because not everyone's going to remember. Some people may have moved away,
yeah.
Died. I mean, there's not, you know, there's going to be... it's not going to be a full thing where they're going to have to, but they're probably going to end up having to pay back a whole bulk of it.
So yeah. There'll be a certain amount of red tape for the red light camera.
There will be red tape. And in some cities, it's not quite clear exactly how, for example, Pembroke Pines has settled, because I think they saw the writing on the wall and they realized, you know, a lot of this, we're going to get tagged down the road. So let's go ahead and just do a settlement now. So some people got partial refunds, not full refunds.
So there's an important question in all of this, which is, first of all, in the year that ended in July 2013, camera fines totaled $62.5 million. The state gets half of that, and the company that makes the cameras get the other half. So we know that it's bringing in revenue, but is there any evidence that it's making people drive more safely?
Well, I guess it kind of depends who you talk to. I mean, for example, Aventura was very, very... forthright, and very, they were really pushing that accidents had plummeted, and you also have people that say, well, it may even be worse because, you know, then you sort of have, you know, people, and I've found myself doing this where I'm like, uh-oh, is it a red light camera? Let me stop really quick, you know, when maybe I would have taken it before, and, you know, so I'm not really sure there's an overall consensus on if it actually makes traffic any safer.
That's David Ovalle with the Miami Herald. Thank you, David. And this is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Alicia Zuckerman, and it's your show, too. You can call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576. Or you can join the conversation at WLRN.org or on Twitter at WLRN. Miami Beach is doing something that no other city in Florida has done so far. The city will be offering transgender health benefits, and actually only a handful of cities around the country, just 5%, offer these benefits. Steve Rothaus from the Miami Herald, what motivated Miami Beach to do this now?
Well, it was very interesting that back in April, just about the time of Miami Beach Gay Pride, the city leaders and the Human Rights Campaign announced that Miami Beach had received a perfect score on the Human Rights Campaign's Municipal Equality Index. And the reason why they received this perfect score and had not even been scored earlier was because they self-submitted. The Miami Beach GLBT, Business Enhancement Committee, they were very much, you know, perturbed that HRC, the Human Rights Campaign, had not evaluated them. The reason why they hadn't been evaluated was because the city of Miami Beach didn't fit the criteria for evaluation. It wasn't a large enough city, it didn't have a large enough population, and it didn't have a university. So, you know, basically, those are the kinds of things. And that's why when you see some of these cities, you think, oh, why are they being evaluated, not Miami Beach? Well, because they fit this narrow, you know, criteria. And so, but HRC said to Miami Beach, you can self-submit. And when they did, they received a perfect score, which was, you know, basically, you know, receiving points for things like having domestic partner benefits, for doing outreach, for having police department training, those kinds of things. And transgender health benefits for the first 2 years that they were evaluating cities were bonus points. Mm. So that meant that if you had transgender health benefits, you could actually get higher than a perfect score, because these were bonus points that were assigned.
Extra credit.
Exactly.
So, Steve, what are transgender health benefits? How do they differ from other health benefits?
Well, I mean, they are health benefits, but they cover procedures such as, mastectomies for female-to-male transgender people. They would cover, you know, other kinds of surgical procedures that only transgender people would consider, hormone treatments. What they don't cover generally are things like electrolysis. People would, you know, like voice retraining mm-hmm. on how to speak. Those are uncovered expenses. But
actual health, things related to the body.
Exactly. And for instance, from male to female surgery, which is considered to be less complicated, it would perhaps be $10,400, based upon studies that were done, prior to Miami Beach, ruling this. For female to male, more expensive because it's a more complicated procedure, $17,000. But basically what HRC is saying and what was told to the city of Miami Beach was that these procedures are not any more expensive than paying for pregnancy care, paying for heart surgery, paying for other kinds of necessary expenses.
And in fact, there was an economic analysis, Steve, in the memo that you posted on your blog posting in Miami Herald, and that the council saw that the additional health benefits on an insurance will cost the city employee, I think, less than a dime of their insurance premium next year in October when these transgender insurance options are paid for, are allowed.
The bottom line is that it's such a small universe of people who would even be submitting these kinds of expenses that it's not the kind of thing that's going to impact the city.
I think they estimated maybe one every 4 years would take advantage of these options.
So in another turnaround for Charlie Crist this week, who used to oppose gay marriage, Amendment 2, which was the constitutional ban on gay marriage that happened in 2008, happened under his watch while he was governor, and he supported that amendment. He just pulled in the endorsement of Equality Florida and other gay rights groups this week. What's going on there?
Well, about a year ago, even before Charlie Crist announced that he was going to be running for governor, he posted on Facebook that he had reevaluated his thinking and that he was now supportive of marriage equality for gays and lesbians, for gay couples. And, what he did basically happened just after the president had made a similar statement. And, what we're seeing is that since 2008, many, if not most, Democratic elected officials have changed their position. Bill Nelson changed his position last year. So what Charlie Crist has done is really no different than what Hillary Clinton did and was, fresh air. She got into this whole discussion with Terry Gross about why she changed her position.
And a lot of public opinion in general.
Yes. Well, between 2008, when 62% of Floridians voted for this, and now 2014, where they're saying 54 to perhaps 56% are in favor of it, there's been a major sea change.
So Chris also said yesterday that the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, should not be using her office to get involved in people's private lives.
There's a bully pulpit that comes with the office of governor. And I think you can appeal to the people of Florida, maybe call the Attorney General and ask her to let individuals in the state of Florida live their lives and keep your nose out of their private life.
So in about 30 seconds, which is all we have, Steve, how is Attorney General Pam Bondi defending the same-sex marriage ban?
Well, I mean, she was under a lot of pressure after she made her initial filing saying that this was going to cause harm for the people of Florida. And then she kind of backed off from that and said, well, I'm simply defending the law that the people of Florida voted. And actually, there was legislation passed in 1977 when gay adoption was banned in Florida. The legislature also, banned gay marriage. But of course, that was by an act of the legislature. So, since 1977, there have actually been laws against this.
Steve Rothaus with the Miami Herald, thanks so much. And that will do it for this edition of the Florida Roundup for Friday, June 13th, 2014. But you can keep the conversation going at WLRN.org and on Twitter at WLRN. If you missed any of today's shows, listen to it again on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. And we'll be posting it to our website again. That's WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Elaine Chen and myself. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Mertz. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. And South Florida Arts Beat is next, including a preview of new music by the great band Gold Dust Lounge. I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.